Hello, and in this half-hour segment, we're going to examine allegations of the involvement of Otto Skorzeny, an SS colonel and one of the most celebrated operatives of the post-World War II Odessa organization, the very powerful and lethal post-World War II SS Underground, which has, among other things, worked with elements of U.S. intelligence in the post-World War II period. Skorzeny was Hitler's commando chief in World War II and one of the main functionaries of the Odessa post-World War II SS Underground. And we've discussed Otto Skorzeny and his career in, among other programs, RFA number 22. Otto Skorzeny also figures very prominently in the vitally important recent book, The Beast Reawakens, by Martin A. Lee. That book was published in hardcover by Little Brown Books. It was recently reviewed in the Sunday Examiner and Chronicle, the Sunday San Francisco Examiner and Chronicle. That review was published on November 30th of 1997. The review was written by Daniel S. Wick, W-I-C-K, identified here as a teacher of history and literature at the University of California at Davis. The review of the Martin Lee book is entitled Nazi Influence at Home and Abroad, subtitled War Criminals and Sympathizers Have Left Their Mark on Europe and the U.S., researcher says. And of Otto Skorzeny and his involvement with not only the Odessa, but also the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi spy outfit that was incorporated into the U.S. intelligence apparatus at the end of World War II, Daniel Wick writes of Martin Lee's research. Former SS Colonel Otto Scarface Skorzeny, capital S-K-O-R-Z-E-N-Y, was Hitler's favorite commando, Lee says. He led the daring rescue of Mussolini from Italian partisans and masterminded the effort of the SS unit members disguised as GIs who sowed disruption in the U.S. Army during the Battle of the Bulge. After the war, the Allies allowed Skorzeny to escape from a prisoner of war camp, Lee alleges. Fleeing to Spain, he became a wealthy arms merchant who kept close contact with Galen and Otto Ernst Rehmer, another SS man who aided in the rescue of Hitler from the 1944 assassination plot against him. Continuing, he, Skorzeny, also trained Palestinian guerrillas in Egypt in the 1950s, according to the book, where one of his students, unquote, was Yasser Arafat. By the way, Skorzeny's many operations around the world, including his profound connections in the Middle East and his connections to elements of the Palestinian National Movement, discussed in, among other programs, RFA number 22. There have also been allegations, and fairly credible allegations, of involvement of not only Otto Skorzeny, but elements of the Odessa Network in the great train robbery that occurred in Britain in August of 1963. That robbery recently came into the news when Brazil refused to extradite Ronald Briggs, one of the convicted robbers in that particular crime. An account of the Brazilian refusal to extradite Ronald Briggs, Biggs, was contained in the San Francisco Examiner, San Francisco Chronicle, rather, of Thursday, November 13th of 1997. The Chronicle entitled this story a Reuters story, Dateline Brasilia. Brazil's Supreme Court refuses to extradite famed train robber. And the article reads, Brazil's Supreme Court ruled yesterday that train robber Ronald Biggs, capital B-I-G-G-S, can remain a free man, throwing out Britain's request for his extradition. The tribunal reached its unanimous decision after declaring Biggs's crimes, his role in the 1963 robbery of a mail train, and his 1965 escape from jail, void under Britain's 20-year statute of limitations. Quote, it was a question of timing, unquote, panel president Celso de Mello said, last name capital or D-E capital M-E-L-L-O, again quoting, if this request had been made earlier, it certainly would have been accepted, unquote. Britain requested the extradition in October, 2 months after signing a long-awaited extradition treaty with Brazil. Biggs, now 68, was sentenced to 30 years imprisonment for his part in the 1963 Great Train Robbery of a Glasgow to London mail train that netted his gang £2.5 million, worth more than $50 million in today's dollars. After his escape from jail in London in 1965, he fled to Australia before ending up in Brazil. There are indications that, in fact, not only the great train robbery itself, but also some of the escape and flight of the suspects in that crime was supported by the famed Odessa Network. The Odessa was the post-World War II SS underground, anticipating military defeat in World War II. In fact, the SS, Hitler's elite guard and the most feared element of the Third Reich, and also the most murderous element, in fact, went underground and formed a very complex and very well-established post-World War II underground organization called the Odessa, for not only the mutual aid and assistance of its various members, but also the perpetuations of the Nazi ideal in the post-World War II period. The Odessa worked very closely with the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi spy outfit that was incorporated into U.S. intelligence at the end of World War II. That discussed, and among other programs, RFA number 3. There are, in fact, indications that Otto Skorzeny and his Odessa organization assisted with the Great Train Robbery, and that a portion of the proceeds from that robbery were in turn contributed to that organization. And in fact, there are allegations that some of the proceeds from the robbery were invested in a Skorzeny-connected real estate project in Spain. Allegations of connections between Skorzeny and the Odessa, what one can properly conclude must have been the Odessa organization and the Great Train Robbery, were contained in a book entitled The Train Robbers. That book was authored by Piers Paul Reed, three words, capital P-I-E-R-S, his middle name Paul, and last name Reed, capital R-E-A-D. The book The Train Robbers was published in hardcover by Lippincott and was copyrighted in 1978, and again, it's by Piers Paul Reed and W.H. Allen and Company. The ISBN number is 0-397-01283-7. Again, published in hardcover by Lippincott, and the book is entitled The Train Robbers by Piers Paul Reed. And in the book, there's a description, first of all, before getting to the connections of the allegations of connections to Otto Skorzeny, there is a summation of Otto Skorzeny's World War II career. And I'm going to read this briefly to give members of the listening audience an understanding of who Otto Skorzeny was and why his alleged connections to the Great Train Robbery are of more than passing interest. Turning to a description of and a summation of Otto Skorzeny's military career contained in The Train Robbers, we read, "Descended from officers in the Austro-Hungarian army, he, Skorzeny, had been born in 1908 into the solid, once comfortable Vienna bourgeoisie. He grew up into a giant of a man with slate-gray eyes and dark, springy hair, and because there was no future in the Austrian army, he trained as an engineer. As a student, he practiced the dueling traditional to the officer class and was slashed on the left cheek, which left a scar from his temple to the corner of his mouth. He wrote his thesis on, quote, the calculation and construction of the diesel engine, unquote, and after graduation became a partner in a construction company, married, and according to the authorized version, settled down to a quiet domestic life. Secretly, however, Skorzeny joined Ernst Kaltenbrunner and Adolf Eichmann in the German Brotherhood, a Nazi Fifth Column organization. He was later to be accused of burning synagogues in Vienna. He was certainly active in the Anschluss undercover of the gymnastic club. By the way, the Anschluss was the Nazi annexation of and subjugation of Austria. Continuing. When the war started in 1939, Skorzeny entered the Waffen-SS as an officer cadet and was soon posted to the 1st SS Regiment, Liebstandarte Adolf Hitler, unquote. After the war, Skorzeny was to claim that the Waffen-SS was merely an elite corps of the German army, and certainly by 1945 it had developed into a force whose chief purpose was to fight the war. But in 1939, when he joined, the Liebstandarte was Hitler's Praetorian Guard, which swore a personal oath of loyalty, bravery, and, quote, obedience unto death, unquote. Skorzeny fought on the Russian front, reached the rank of SS Obersturmführer, and was awarded the Iron Cross, and in December of 1942 was chosen to form the kind of commando units that were being used so effectively by the British in North Africa. He began to plan sabotage in the Middle East that would cut off the Allied oil supplies, but none of his plans came to fruition until Hitler himself selected him to rescue Mussolini from the government of Marshal Badoglio. By the way, Badoglio's last name, capital B-A-D-O-G-L-I-O. This operation was Skorzeny's one undoubted success. After weeks of undercover intelligence work, it was discovered that the deposed dictator was held in a winter sports hotel at the top of the Grand Sasso Mountains in the Apennines. The only access to the hotel was by a funicular railway that was held at both ends by the Italian army. Scorzani and his men crash-landed onto the mountainside in gliders and stormed the hotel. Mussolini was set free and, with Scorzani, was flown from the plateau first to Vienna and then to Hitler, his deliverer, in the Wolf's Lair in East Prussia. This liberation of Mussolini, unquote, did much to raise the Nazis' morale. It also brought Otto Scorzani Hitler's gratitude and esteem, which led in turn to a leap into the aristocracy of the Nazi movement no less spectacular than the assault on the Grand Sasso. He was taken up by Himmler and Bormann, and it was possibly at this stage that he met his second wife, Ilse Schacht, the daughter of former Minister of Finance and plenipotentiary for war, Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht. By the way, Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht was Hitler's most important finance minister. Continuing, while Germany's political and military strength was waning on almost every front, Otto Scorzani fought on with immense enthusiasm, as if convinced that his brand of audacity could win the war. Bolstered by the prestige of his one successful operation, he plundered other regiments of their best men and equipment. He was given carte blanche by Hitler, in particular a signed statement that, quote, Sturmbannführer Scorzani has been directly charged by myself with secret and personal orders of utmost importance. All personnel, military and civil, will assist Sturmbannführer Scorzani by every means and will forward all his wishes, unquote. The results, however, were less spectacular than the means at his disposal. When Admiral Horthy of Hungary was suspected by Hitler of preparing a separate peace with the Allies, Scorzani and his men, through a mixture of force and guile, took the Regent's Palace in the center of Budapest, but Scorzani failed to find Tito in the Balkans or alter the outcome of the Battle of the Bulge by sending saboteurs behind the lines in American uniforms. As the war drew to its close, Scorzani acted as the operational arm of those leading Nazis who intended to survive their inevitable defeat. Bormann sent him to retrieve a truckload of secret documents, but these were captured by the advancing Russians. Walter Schellenberg, the chief of military intelligence after the arrest of Admiral Canaris, and his deputy, Reinhard Galen, were planning to exchange immunity from the Americans for the intelligence and resistance networks which Galen and Scorzani had set up behind the Russian lines. When Scorzani was told to form a last redoubt in the Alps around Berchtesgaden, Schellenberg and Galen sent their records to be hidden behind the, quote, ring of steel, unquote. By the way, Schellenberg was in charge of foreign intelligence for the Sicherheitsdienst, that was the SS intelligence service. Continuing, Walter Funk, capital F-U-N-K, Schacht's successor as Minister of Economics and President of the Reichsbank, also appeared with a state treasure to add to the gold and jewels that the Nazis themselves had brought to bury in the mountains. It was here that Scorzani and an elite of SS officers waited for the end. On April 30th, 1945, Hitler killed himself in Berlin. For some weeks afterward, Scorzani remained hidden in the Alps, assisting the more notorious Nazis to make good their escape via Italy to Spain and South America. Scorzani himself then surrendered to the Americans. There was little evidence that he was guilty of specific war crimes, and his very size, together with the scar on his cheek, made it unlikely that he would have escaped detection had he chosen to leave. It is probable, too, that like Galen and Schellenberg, Scorzani had already reached some understanding with the British and American secret services. By the way, this book was authored in 1978. Books that have come out since that time have made it only too clear that Scorzani had gone to work like Galen for Western intelligence. However, recent titles, such as the aforementioned The Beast Reawakens, have made it clear that Galen and the related Odessa networks were also working with the Soviets at the same time. Continuing, speaking of Scorzani, the book says, he was tried as a war criminal at Dachau, but the charges of shooting American prisoners of war and ordering the assassination of Eisenhower could not be proved against him. The prosecution case collapsed when a British agent, Forrest Yeo Thomas, gave evidence for the defense that the Allies, too, had disguised their men in enemy uniforms. Scorzani was acquitted, but was held for a time for denazification, unquote. He was allowed out of prison every now and then to visit his family and was followed by Allied agents in the hope that he would lead them to more notorious war criminals. On July 27, 1948, Skorzeny escaped in the trunk of a car from the camp where he was held. He returned to the Alps around Berchtesgaden, purportedly to regain his health, but quite possibly to look for the buried treasure. Shortly afterward, his father-in-law, Hjalmar Schacht, who had been classified as a major Nazi offender and sentenced to 8 years in prison, was released, and almost overnight he was directing a major West German bank of which he soon became president. Skorzeny himself now went to Buenos Aires and then Madrid, where the governments of both Perón and Franco were sympathetic to fugitive Nazis. In Madrid, as in Vienna before the war, Skorzeny established a legitimate business. In reality, he and a former Luftwaffe pilot, Hans Ulrich Rudel, set up Odessa, providing former members of the SS with money, plastic surgery, and contacts in South America. Their operations were international, but then so too were their clientele, for by the end of the war, foreigners outnumbered native Germans in the ranks of the Waffen-SS. Of the 38 SS divisions in existence in 1945, none was exclusively German, and at least 19 consisted largely of foreign personnel. The scattered remnants of possibly the largest multinational army ever to fight under one flag now reformed into a conspiratorial mutual aid society with branches all over the world. When the former chief of the Gestapo in Lyon, Klaus Barbie, was arrested in 1972, he named Otto Skorzeny as the chief of the network called Die Spinne, which could command the loyalty of 100,000 fascist sympathizers in 22 countries and was funded by Nazi investments. By the way, in the book The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Kruger, published by the South End Press in Boston in 1980, Skorzeny is identified as the director of the Internationale Fascista, an organization that undoubtedly overlaps Die Spinne and the Odessa. Continuing. When Perón was overthrown in 1955, many of the ex-Nazis whom he had employed either fled the country or went underground. An attempt was made to use Ireland as a new base of operations. Skorzeny bought an estate near Cork, and Skorzeny and two representatives of a German and Swiss bank had protracted talks with members of the Irish government, promising to transfer considerable sums of capital to aid its economic development. This venture failed, largely because the traditional antagonism of the Irish toward the English did not extend to sympathy for ex-Nazis. Skorzeny himself, who had expected a demand for his services as a guerrilla expert, was forced to sell his estate because of the antagonism of his tenants. The more notorious war criminals were thus forced to live incognito in the unhealthy and uncivilized corners of Paraguay, Bolivia, and Brazil. Madrid remained safe for Skorzeny, Rudel, and the other more, quote, respectable, unquote, ex-Nazis. They were invited by Franco to look upon Spain as their second fatherland, unquote, and Skorzeny took him at his word. He entertained his friends in Horcher's restaurant. Horcher had been a protege of Goering, which was patronized by many of Franco's cabinet, and it was here that he took June to lunch. That was the wife of one of the robbers. He was given a Nansen passport, capital N-A-N-S-E-N, and used it to travel from Madrid all over the world. In 1951, he attended a conference of European fascists, the European Social Movement, in Malmo in Sweden. From that time on, the presence of Skorzeny was reported in Cairo, Malmo, Tangier, Buenos Aires, and Rome, as well as in many German and Austrian towns. In 1971, Skorzeny developed cancer of the spine. He was operated on in Germany, but died in Spain on July 5, 1975. His body was cremated in Madrid at a ceremony attended by a mixed gathering of Germans and Spaniards. Afterward, his ashes were flown to Vienna, where, in the suburban cemetery of Döbling, they were buried in his family plot. And that is who Otto Skorzeny was, and hence the allegations of his involvement in the great train robbery were all the more interesting and all the more significant. Of how the author of this book, again entitled The Train Robbers, authored by Pierce Paul Reed, how he came across the allegations of the Skorzeny involvement is set forth by the author as follows. There was a Mr. Big behind the crime, a man who had financed it and had received in turn £1 million of the stolen money. He was Otto Skorzeny, the officer in the Waffen-SS who had commanded the German commandos during the war and had rescued Mussolini from the Gran Sasso, where he had been imprisoned by the government of Marshal Badoglio. Skorzeny had put up £80,000. One of his men had been at their hideout, Leather Slade Farm. Others had abducted Charlie Wilson from Winston Green Prison. They had arranged for Buster Edwards to leave the country and have his appearance changed by plastic surgery. Scorzani himself was now dead, but his organization was still intact. Indeed, Buster Edwards and Donald Cook were at that very moment meeting with one of Scorzani's subordinates at the Dorchester Hotel to ask if they could name her former chief. My reaction to this news, that is the author's reaction, Piers Paul Reed, my reaction to this news was one of mixed excitement and skepticism. I knew that though Scorzani in his lifetime had presented himself as an audacious but honorable soldier who after the war had gone into business in Spain, he was suspected to have been the founder of ODESSA, the worldwide organization of former members of the SS. The idea that these old Nazis had sustained themselves through crime struck me as an extraordinary story which should certainly be told to the world. On the other hand, if the train robbers had reckoned that the publishers, like the public, were tired of their old story, they could not have invented a more piquant sauce to spice up the reheated stew. I was well aware how skilled and experienced thieves could be in fabrication, and I realized that it was not impossible, given the facilities of prison libraries and the time spent alone in a cell, for the train robbers to have invented the whole story. In the days that followed, I had further meetings with Buster Edwards and Jim Hussey, H-U-S-S-E-Y, the two who had the closest links with the Germans. The principal indication that the story was true was Buster Edwards' reluctance to tell it. Though Jim Hussey had been the first to make contact with Scorzani's organization, Buster alone had been to Cologne after the robbery and knew the full story of their German partner. By the way, I would also add that a few years ago, Buster Edwards was found dead in alleged suicide. He had allegedly hung himself. And again, he was the one who knew the most about this connection. Continuing. Buster alone had been to Cologne after the robbery and knew the full story of their German partner. His wife, June, was the only person to have met Otto Scorzani himself, and because they both felt grateful for what he had done to help them, they were loath even now to betray him, for when in the Dorchester Hotel Buster had asked for permission to name him, the representative of Scorzani's organization, a woman called Hanna Schmidt, had refused point blank, saying that in Germany Scorzani was revered by many as a national hero, and his name could not be linked with a common crime. It was Donald Cook who goaded Buster on to tell his story, saying quite rightly that the publishers, having scented a sensation, would not now pay for anything less. He persuaded Buster that he owed it to the rest of the gang, who were apparently penniless, to help them find their feet by earning enough from the book to start some legitimate business. Buster eventually agreed, and June, at his request, agreed to tell her side of the story. June Edwards finally convinced me that the story was true. She was, after all, such a direct, instinctive woman that it went against any reasonable appreciation of her character to believe that she, who had suffered so much from the crime, should enter into a substantial deception. More convincing still, she let slip a detail in her story which, by chance, was the first fragment of evidence we could hope to corroborate. She described how at lunch with Scorzani in Madrid, she had met an editor of Reader's Digest who could speak a number of Chinese dialects. As it happened, one of the publishers knew the man and was able to confirm that he had indeed been a friend of Otto Scorzani. And more of how the robbers came in contact with Scorzani's organization. This concerned the imprisonment in Germany, specifically in Munich, of a fellow named Jim Hussey, last name H-U-S-S-E-Y, who was imprisoned for picking pockets at the Oktoberfest, and it was while in prison that he met a former member of the Waffen-SS named Horst, who was a member of the Scorzani network. This is described by Reed as follows. The pickpockets, including Jim Hussey. They were taken first to a temporary police station set up for the Oktoberfest, and then to the central police station where Jim was separated from his friends. He spent 5 nights in a cell with a German prisoner and was then transferred to Neudeck Prison on the outskirts of the city where he was held pending a trial. The regulations were strict, the food was bad, and Jim was shut in a cell for 23 hours a day with 2 German thieves whose language he could not speak. There was a toilet in the cell but no heat, and the only visit he received was from the wife of one of the other thieves, who left him some money to buy jam, a luxury to add to the daily diet of sausage, bread, and potato. Toward the middle of November, Jim was transferred to another cell at the end of the row, which he shared with a man called Horst. Horst was strong and stocky, around 10 years older than Jim, and he spoke some English. Before long, the two men became friends, and Horst's conversation did much to lift Jim out of the depression he had felt upon finding himself back in prison. They talked about their pasts. Jim said he was there for picking pockets, and Horst hinted that he had been imprisoned for smuggling arms. Once, when Horst was washing, Jim noticed a number on the skin under his arm. It was his blood group, Horst explained, tattooed onto him as a young recruit in the Waffen-SS. Although Jim was guarded about his criminal career, news of his earlier 5-year sentence had seeped into the prison, and Horst seemed eager to know if Jim was a big-time gangster. Not wishing to play down this source of respect, Jim intimated obliquely that he and his friends were among the strongest gangs in London, upon which Horst said to him that if they ever wanted help of any kind, either logistics or finance, he knew of an organization that could provide it. And then later, as the robbers were planning the robbery of the mail train, they made contact with Horst's organization in Germany. And that is described here by Reed. From Buster's flat in Twickenham, Jim Hussey called the number in Munich he had been given by Horst. They had an amicable conversation before Jim got around to business, and then, since little could be said over the telephone, it was no more than a reference to what they had discussed in prison and an invitation to come to London. Horst accepted, and Jim met him at the airport. He drove him to the Regent's Palace Hotel in Piccadilly, where Bruce and Buster were waiting, and over tea they outlined in vague terms their plan to stop the mail train. All they required was some risk capital to secure the services of a train expert and keep the different members of the gang out of trouble during the time it took to plan the raid. Horst appeared to think that the organization he had talked of would be interested in such an investment if the return was adequate and if it was convinced that their gang was really capable of such an operation. He asked for some proof that they were in that league, and Bruce told him that they had pulled off the airport robbery. Horst seemed impressed. He agreed to report back to the organization and inform Jim of the result. 10 days later, Horst returned to London with another German called Karl. Karl was an older man, around 50, and to all outward appearances a successful businessman, plump, sunburned, and well-dressed. This time, Bruce had arranged their meeting in the Ritz, and once again he outlined their plans. When he had finished, Karl asked how much financing he thought they would need. £20,000 now, said Bruce, and possibly 20 more later on. That should be possible, said Karl. We could provide you with as much as you need, but in return, we would want £2 million of the proceeds, unquote. Bruce and Buster seemed unperturbed by this demand. They said that they would have to consult their friends, and the three men parted, having agreed to meet again in the Ritz Hotel the following afternoon. And eventually, an agreement was reached by the robbers to utilize their German contacts for financing and logistical support in this crime. And as we shall see, that support proved to be considerable. Let me give you the address, etc., for Spitfire, the tape duplication service that stocks all of the various tapes that I've produced. They stock the various half-hour segments, the various interviews that I've done, all of the archive shows. They stock the weekly One Step Beyond shows, and most of the tapes of the lectures that I've done as well. You can contact Spitfire at P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. Email address, ALCALAME, that's ALCALAME, at ix.netcom.com. And a list of and description of all of the programs available from Spitfire is on the KFJC webpage at www.kfjc.org. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.